Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in the prison system and beyond.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
Before we get started with this week's theme, we wanted to share some prison-related news and announcements.
42 people being held at ICE's Golden State Annex facility have been on hunger strike. The strike is in protest over medical care, food, phone calls, solitary confinement, and the unjust denial of liberty at the center, which is in McFarland, California, about 130 miles north of Los Angeles, and which is run by the for-profit prison corporation, the GEO Group. The hunger strike raises the intensity of a protest that began on July 2nd with a work stoppage by 59 detainees, both in this center and at another GEO Group facility in Mesa Verde in Bakersfield, California, about 26 miles away. People held in these facilities typically work scrubbing bathrooms and cutting hair for $1 a day. The strikers demand not only changes in the conditions of their confinement, but also that ICE sever its contract with the GEO Group. As one striker, a father of three who has been in the U.S. since he was 2 years old, commented, "There is no humane way to manage these places. In order for cases to be reviewed fairly, detainees must be granted freedom," he pointed out, quote, "The fact that I am here, I don't even understand why. I am locked up over a civil matter. People are not detained over a civil matter." An incarcerated woman died from heat stroke in a central Californian prison on July 6 as temperatures in the area soared to over 113 degrees, according to a release from the California Coalition for Women Prisoners. Staff at the prison, the Central California Women's Facility, failed to implement even the most basic heat precautions. The woman became incoherent, attempted to cool down in a shower, fell down, and began to suffer convulsions. She was taken to a hospital where she died. Even after her death, the prison did nothing to address ongoing fatal overheating in the facility. Simple measures such as ice chips, ice water, electrolytes, and cooling towels could be, but are not being taken. People incarcerated at this facility and others have been calling CCWP in distress, warning of 92-degree temperatures in the halls and 97 in cells or rooms. People are suffering migraines and vomiting. This crisis comes nearly a year after the Modesto Bee ran an expose on severe heat-related problems at the prison. Nothing has changed.
In this episode, we air a recording from the final talk of the recent Pittsburgh Anti-Repression Convergence, which served as a space for activists, political prisoner supporters, and former political prisoners to strategize against repression in the context of social movements, with an eye towards total liberation for the earth and all of its inhabitants. We'll hear now from Sheila, who defines and discusses anti-repression, counter-repression, and movement defense. They began their presentation with the reading of Dianne de Prima's Revolutionary Letter No. 8. Quote, "Every time you pick the spot for a BN, a demonstration, a march, a rally, you are choosing the ground for a potential battle. You are still calling these shots. Pick your terrain with that in mind. Remember the old gang rules. Stick to your neighborhood. Don't let them lure you to Central Park every time. I would hate to stumble bloody out of that park to find help. Central Park West or Fifth Avenue, which would you choose? Go to Lovin's with incense, flowers, food, and a plastic bag with a damp cloth in it for tear gas. Wear no jewelry, wear clothes you can move in easily, wear no glasses, contact lenses. Earrings for pierced ears are especially hazardous. Try to be clear in front what you will do if it comes to trouble. If you're going to try to split, stay out of the center. Don't stampede or panic others. Don't waver between active and passive resistance. Know your limitations. Bear contempt, neither for yourself nor any of your brothers. No one way works, and it will take all of us shoving at the thing from all sides to bring it down." Here's Sheila.
There's just one of me up here, but I would be really remiss to not note that there are actually many, many other people who are up here with me, and there are many people who are not in this room that are actually in this room with us. Be those ancestors, be those like your biological ones. Should you be so blessed that they were revolutionaries or that they believed in your revolutionary potential? Or our revolutionary ancestors, chosen and otherwise, whose names are known and unknown to us. And then there's also talk about the Tesseract, or however you say it, the collapse timeline, if you're using some other words. There's actually all of our descendants in this room with us, too, and they are living in the revolutionary world that we have crafted. And we might not ever see it, but they sure as f*** seeing it right now. So I also, as a grounding, want to point out how many people have been here over the course of the last several days. Yesterday, somebody said that they counted close to 175 people packed into this room. And I have done this kind of work, movement defense, anti-oppression. We're going to do semantics of those things in a second. But I've done that for the better part of 2 decades. And I have actually never seen so many people crammed into a room to talk about threat modeling or talk about prisoner support. And this used to actually be the thing that maybe 10 of us, we could get in a room to talk about it. And we thought we were really hot shit when a decade ago, we could get 75 people in a room to talk about it at a national conference that happened. And so I just want to like give that perspective. I am far from an elder. Please don't call me one. But I haven't earned that title yet. But I've been around just long enough to know that actually our movements have grown exponentially in the last decade. Since 2014, when Ferguson happened, to now, our movements have exploded. And there have been moments, I'm going to say the thing that nobody else has said on a microphone yet, there have been moments of conflict this weekend. Moments where somebody said something and somebody else said something, and maybe even somebody spacked us. But let me just say that actually, when there are so many people who are part of revolutionary movements, that we can start to factionalize and be like, well, your politics are this and mine are actually this and those are anarchy or whatever. Like, that's actually a sign of our success and our strength. And we will learn and we will adapt to what it means to not repress ourselves, but to move through conflict or step away from conflict in a way that is generative and allows for many, many, many people to keep pushing at all the different sides. Because not one way is going to work. And so if you or your friends or your friends back home think one way is going to work, it's not. One way can't work. And we need everybody pushing at every side of the so that we can move forward towards total liberation. All right, that's my little soapbox. Oh, no, I have one more thing. This is the last part of my soapbox. Is that our movements do not require friendship. You don't have to be friends with any in this room. You do not have to be friends with me. And I might not want to be friends with you. And I used to be a part of movements, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, where there were few of us who were interested in militant, revolutionary worlds and possibilities to move us all, right, towards total liberation for the whole earth and all its inhabitants. And there weren't that many of us. And when there's only 20 people in the room in your town, you gotta be friends with everybody. And you actually really kind of do need to maintain friendship with people, right? As our movements grow and become bigger and more powerful and more effective, I don't think we have to be friends with everyone. But we do have to hold each other with regard. And sometimes that means stepping away or saying like, you know what, I'm not going on that thing. Or, you know what, those people are like, they're pushing at that side, I'm pushing on this side. There's a lot of like very beautiful, romantic, anarchist stickers and t-shirts and things still floating around out there that talk about like, you know, friendship and friendship is forms of life and people in the crowd. But friendship is forms of life. That's what we do with our friends. And we can do revolution with many, many, many more people than our friends can be better. Things that we can do it with only our friends. So, with all that as our grounding, I'm going to make a quick case against anti-repression. Big quotes, TM. I'm going to use a couple of terms, and I just want to define those really quickly. First, I'm going to talk about, well, actually, I'm not going to define them. I'm going to tell you what they are. I'm going to define one of them. The terms I'm going to be using are anti-repression, movement defense, and counter-repression. And what I mean by repression, that's the thing I'm going to define for us right now, just for the purposes of this conversation today. Repression is the means by which the state, capital, and those who hold power over maintain their authority and legitimacy. It's happening all the time. Sometimes it's really, really flashy and big, and sometimes it's just all those flock cameras somebody mentioned earlier in the day, right? They're just like all over many, many cities, and if they're not in yours, they're probably on their way in there, right? That's like low-level constant repression that's happening not only to people who are revolutionary actors or activists or part of movements or whatever, it's happening to everyone who causes any kind of threat to the maintenance of status quo, normalcy, legitimacy, and authority of the state, capital, and those who hold power over. And so repression also is not like a mysterious thing that we need to be surprised by. Some people probably know more about science than I do. That's not my main focus. But in physics, I think there's the law of cause and effect. When you make yourself and your movements a threat to the continued power, legitimacy, and authority of the state, capital, and those who hold power over, they will respond by trying to make all of that stop by whatever means necessary. And they really by whatever means necessary. And I don't need to tell all of you what repression is, but I just want to ground it a little bit. So if repression is not a thing that we need to be surprised by, what I might also encourage you to consider is that it is not a thing to avoid, but rather to anticipate and mitigate and then disperse the energy of so that we can continue to move towards total liberation. If it is a law of cause and effect, why are we surprised and caught off guard when it happens? We could say many, many different answers to it. I don't know if this is an exact answer, but another beloved ancestor, David Graeber, wrote in an essay in 2008 titled The Shock of Victory, this quote: "The biggest problem facing direct action movements is that we don't know how to handle victory. The real problem such movements face is that they always get taken by surprise by the speed of their initial success. We are never prepared for victory. It throws us into confusion. We start fighting each other. The ratcheting up of repression and appeals to nationalism that inevitably accompany some new war mobilization," he's talking about the anti-war movements, "then play into the hands of authoritarians on every side of the political spectrum. As a result, by the time the full impact of our initial victory becomes clear, we're usually too busy feeling like failures to even notice it." Repression feels very, very bad, and everybody in this room is living it, and we know it. But it is a sign of our continued victories. It means that we are an actual threat to the maintenance of the power, legitimacy, and authority of the state, capital, and those who are trying to wield power over all of us. And so the goal is not to avoid repression. It's simply to make sure that we are mitigating it, that we are, and we can do that best when we anticipate it, right? We anticipate it, we mitigate it, we navigate it, we disperse its energy and thereby its power. And then what that allows for us to do is carve out the tactical freedoms to reach our goals. And the goals of revolutionary movements, no matter which faction you're part of real revolutionary movements, is total liberation for the earth and all of its inhabitants. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the state of what I'm calling TM, trademarked anti-repression. And no shade, I'm going to clarify, I don't think we need new words necessarily, but for the sake of the conversation, what I think the state of anti-repression is, as we are becoming more and more victorious, is that it is becoming largely risk avoidant, it is becoming largely self-protective, and thereby self-defeating by embracing narratives of losing. Powerful movements around the world for time immemorial have huge casualty, loss, and cost. You remember the threat modeling conversation. We talked about the cost, right? How much is this going to cost me? Total liberation is going to cost us everything. And we are very unlikely not only to live to see it, but we're also very unlikely, I think, to be suitable to be the ones to enact it once we get past the barriers in front of us. That will be the descendants that I mentioned are in this room with us, right? And so why am I talking about, well, we're not gonna do anti-repression anymore? That's not what I'm trying to say. What I wanna say is, for the purposes of conversation, for us to think together, strategize together, to understand our victories, and thereby mitigate the losses that are an inevitable part of it, and continue moving forward, the specificity of our language matters. It matters how we talk to each other. It doesn't matter what shit we put on a flyer so people will come. Call whatever's gonna get people in the god door. We need you here. And we actually, it's amazing that so many people are here, but we need many, many more of us. So a few years ago, there was a zine that maybe many of you remember. It was like something about allies versus accomplices. I'm not suggesting that we replace old words with new words as a form of virtue signaling. And that's a risk that we run when we talk about language in this way. But what I am encouraging us to do is to have internal conversations, and using this kind of three-part framework that I'm gonna break down of like, what are the defining characteristics, as we have seen them, of anti-repression, movement defense, and counter-repression. So these are what I would say are defining characteristics of these approaches to repression mitigation. The first being anti-repression. If I was to try and put it into one sentence, which is a terrible idea, I would say avoidance first. If avoidance fails, reduction of harm. What does that look like? It looks like focusing on the legal apparatus. It looks like specialization. Specialization often leads to identification, as our friends previously mentioned, with defendant versus supporter as static locations. It's segregated as protection from the very movements that it ostensibly, and I'm using this word intentionally, serves. It has a high reliance on professionals who hold things like bar cards or know how to like log into e-file things. Y'all, any one of you can e-file something. We'll circle back to that later. I'm trying to give a historical example for each one of these things. This first one is not meant to hurt a single person in this room's feeling. I was very integral in this campaign. I believe that it was successful, and I think we fell into a lot of these traps that now we are all dealing with. That historical example of the trappings of anti-repression, as I just described them, is J20. Sorry, everybody. One of the things that was the hardest part about that, as somebody who was working as a supporter or a non-attorney legal worker, is that despite the fact, and I'll say it on the microphone, despite the fact that I was there that day on January 20th in DC, despite that, I was just a supporter. Y'all, I took those risks with you, and it doesn't mean that I now have to like be subservient about your fucking kombucha at court support because you're a defendant. Yes, you are facing the sheer violence of the state in a way that I'm not when it comes to the legal apparatus, but for those of you who were part of J20 support and going to court, and maybe you were a defendant, or maybe you loved somebody, or somebody in your town was a defendant, you know that actually everybody who showed up to court was at risk every single day that we went there. We were being heavily surveilled. We were being intimidated. We were being followed to the places that we would stay and to the train station after court. So this idea that somebody is in this static location, and even worse, the idea that it is an identity of defendant, how fucking sad is it when we let the state define who we are? You are not anybody who's facing charges in this room for any reason. I'm facing charges. I'm not a defendant. I'm a revolutionary. And I hope to say that. The defining characteristics that I would say for repression mitigation when it comes to movement defense. Movement defense is a wing of the movement tasked with maintaining the tactical freedom to achieve movement goals. It is constantly interacting with and strategizing with the offensive line. I forgot to tell you a little warning. I'm using sports metaphors. Experimenting with that, and the only sport that I know anything about, and please don't ask me about it later, is football. And so I'm gonna use sports metaphors because I feel like it's a little less alienating than if I'm gonna start talking about like military terms. Although my friend righteously pointed out to me that actually a lot of the sports terms are military terms. But when I say that, so that we're not thinking of like, you know, military bros with like Velcro patches or whatever, which is annoying. Just imagine like all of us on a football field together.
Yeah.
Which sounds funny. It does sound funny. But it is constantly movement defense. Part of that is constantly interacting with and strategizing with the offensive line. The defensive line is not a rear guard, meaning like you're not doing shit, you're sitting home on your laptop e-filing. It means that you are actively making sure that you are carving out the tactical freedom for the offensive line. Sometimes they're like little guys who can like move fast through the big guys on the other team, right? And they like make it further down the field. That's the extent of everything I know about football. It is not separate. Movement defense is not separate. It is fully integrated. There is a refusal of, quote, professionals coming to the rescue. That doesn't mean, like, don't have a lawyer. Please never tell anyone that that's what you heard me say. Well, I represent yourself every time. No, that's not what I'm suggesting. But it is a refusal of this professionalization of our revolutionary goals. We will use lawyers, my lawyer friends who may or may not be in the room, we will use you as tools, right? And if you're a part of our movement and you want to be our teammate on the field, welcome to the defensive line. But we don't need movement attorneys. We need teammates. We need comrades. Be that. Risk your bar card. I kind of went off track, but the bullet point said, demanding professionals and others take risks with us. That sounded a little bit more palatable. And then I said, demand teammates. Okay, I want to give you a historical example of this. The historical example of what I would say movement defense is the Panther 21. Okay, this is 1971. One of those people, there's 21 of them, there's what, 11, 13, 13, I think, that sat trial. One of them is Tupac Shakur's mom, Afeni Shakur. If you ever want to be like really inspired, look up like Afeni Shakur trial quotes. She represented herself. She represented herself pregnant and barely a legal adult, you know, like a couple years past being a teenager. And she did that because some movement supporters hired her a lawyer, including her then partner, I'm the father of her child, biological father, hired her a lawyer, a woman that she was like, that woman is meek as f***. Don't judge Elizabeth, this lady in court, I gotta do this on my own. And then she did, right? Again, I'm not suggesting that's like the prize movement strategy, but I'm saying we shouldn't be afraid to tell our supporters, if we are in these positions, that actually your support's not what I'm looking for. right? Support me. And some people didn't support her in representing herself. But if you go to freedomarchives.org later and you're like looking up shit about the Panther 21 or you find documentary or whatever, I'm not here to be like, recommended if you like, but you'll see that who was victorious in the end of that, right? Who had the wisdom to trust their revolutionary impulses in that situation. And it was not the people who were wringing their hands about what Afeni did or did not do. So I'm going to read this quote. Some people know about the accidental death with the Weather Underground, where they people were building explosives in a townhome in New York City, and there was an incident that occurred, and a number of people were killed because the bomb-making supplies ignited or whatever. Again, I'm not a physicist or a scientist, so I don't know how that works. But it exploded, and people died. And the Weather Underground, an armed revolutionary movement, was really licking their wounds. And they released a statement that then the Panther 21 defendants responded to in a letter that they published, and it's the Panther letter to the Weather Underground. The Panther 21 said to the Weather Underground after this happened, amid their retreat, they said, another facet to be considered is that there is a world of difference between a movement and a revolution. Movements can go in many directions, all at one time, and can only be used up to a certain point. Like the essence of the government's power has been force and its ability to maintain a certain gap between the people's beliefs and the beliefs of society. For what the people do not understand, they cannot control. A movement can deal with the belief reality gap, but not with force. The only thing that can deal with reactionary force and violence is revolutionary counterforce and counterviolence.
This has been KiteLine. Thank you to everyone who contributed to the show. You can follow KiteLine Radio on all social media platforms. And if you want to financially support our work, you can become a supporter at patreon.com/KiteLine Radio. Any funds raised beyond operating costs will be sent to folks on the inside. Please check out our new searchable website with hundreds of archived shows at kitelineradio.org. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. KiteLine, WFHB, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the opinions expressed on the show. Thank you for listening.
We need teammates, we need comrades. Be that.